Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, June 17th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, RRC mulls recommendations to reduce flaring, by Mella McEwen. Various stakeholders weighed in Tuesday as Texas's three railroad commissioners considered Commission Chairman Wayne Christian's Blue Ribbon Task Force for Oil Economic Recovery recommendations on the issue of flaring. At their open meetings, the commissioners heard from three panels, one comprised of the environmental community, one of producers, and the third of industry associations that head up the task force. One thing I hope the three panels have brought is certainty, said Christian, such as the certainty the agency brought in May when it decided against enacting pro-rationing for the first time in 50 years. He expressed hope that highlighting the efforts to eliminate flaring and improve the industry's environmental impact would draw investors back to the industry. Christian also suggested the state put together a Shark Tank-type program that reviews new technology and offers a combination of state and private funding to develop and commercialize that technology. Commissioner Christy Craddock said her office has been working on the issue for some time and said it should be a priority to find ways to improve data collection and make that data more transparent and usable, not just to regulators and the industry, but also to the public. Christian called for the RRC staff to consider the recommendations and come back to the commissioners this fall with a plan of action. Task Force Recommendations. The heads of four of the industry associations leading the task force discussed the report they provided to the commissioners. Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, highlighted recommendations that include reducing administrative time to flare by 50% and enhancing data submissions to increase accountability. There are six key elements of these recommendations we'd like to work on with you and other stakeholders, he said. Those elements include a proposed flaring metrics guide for application of statewide Rule 32 on flaring of new wells, enhancing the Rule 32 data sheet, developing a new report that includes increased transmission and submission of usable information, updating the production report that delineates reporting of vented and flared volumes, and establishing best practices in the industry. Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, reported that $4.5 billion in pipelines are expected to come into service over the next year, which should meet transportation needs and help reduce flaring. We did not get here overnight, he said. Over 10 years, production in the Permian Basin has more than quadrupled, and infrastructure has been strained under that growth. Shepard said the PBPA believes economics and environmental stewardship can go hand in hand. This set of recommendations is the first step in changing the culture in the industry with regards to flaring. Jason Moglen, president of Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, said one size fits all does not work for all operators, and these recommendations do a good job of allowing for flexibility. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, told the commission that progress had been made, but we can do more. We do see this as a long-term process, he said. Operators speak. Kirk Edwards, president of Latigo Petroleum, called on the commission to use its power to implement production limits to help eliminate flaring by limiting the production from new wells until operators can demonstrate adequate takeaway capacity and without flaring permit extensions. Doing so would stop waste, improve recovery, and thus increase tax revenues for state and local entities, he said. Stephanie Reed, Senior Vice President Corporate Development, Land and Midstream with Parsley Energy, said her company's success in reducing flaring was not by accident. Reducing routine flaring requires long-term planning, including investing millions in takeaway infrastructure. The company sets corporate goals and ties compensation to meeting those goals, she said. Parsley has also created more transparency around its flaring volumes, both internally and externally. Daily reports issued company-wide detail flaring events, what led to those events, and what plans are in place to ensure such events don't happen again, she said. Operating responsibility is a function of advanced planning and working with the local communities, Reed said. Each operator has a unique situation to deal with, but commitment is the first step. Mike Starrett, Vice President, Domestic Health Safety and Environment at Occidental Petroleum, told the commissioners his company's work to limit or eliminate routine flaring is part of its preparation for a low-carbon future. Like Reed, Starrett said it takes commitment and employee buy-in. Occidental uses site-specific planning, evaluating and identifying natural gas takeaway capacity and facility design, uses surveillance, monitoring and repair to mitigate flaring, trains its personnel, and requires timely reporting of flaring events, he said. The company is participating in the industry association-led Texas Methane and Flaring Coalition to help facilitate understanding of the issue, he said. Why is flaring occurring? How much is occurring? Once the Railroad Commission understands those questions, it will be well-positioned to identify solutions, Starrett said. Trammell Crowe with EarthX pointed out that $750 million in natural gas was flared in Texas in 2018 and urged everyone to think of it as a resource and a commodity rather than a waste. He expressed disappointment with the various non-government organizations that oppose things such as pipelines and oppose settlements that aren't 100% victories for them. The natural world is in dire straits, he said, but there are realistic economic solutions, such as forward-thinking companies using flared gas to generate electricity instead of sending it into the atmosphere. His father knew we were stewards of the land, Crowe said. Conservation of nature is one of the greatest value systems. Colin Layden, Director Regulatory and Legislative Affairs with the Environmental Defense Fund, said the regulatory agency took a tough stand against flaring in the 1930s and 40s. Yet, he said, we're here talking about the problem again today because it hasn't been fixed. This is a new day and a new opportunity to get it right. Operators are taking steps to eliminate flaring by making the decision to not complete wells until takeaway infrastructure is in place or shutting in wells until adequate infrastructure is in place. Layden said elected officials want to do what's right by the people of Texas, and he encouraged the commissioners to take concrete steps to eliminate routine flaring by 2025. I keep landing on one simple truth. The practice of flaring doesn't reflect our values, Layden said. No one likes waste and no one likes pollution. The industry says it doesn't like it either, but it's not going away because we haven't changed the incentives. And that can't change until the commission acts. Cyrus Reed, interim director of the Lone Star chapter of the Sierra Club, called Tuesday's discussion a first step and praised the EDF's goal of eliminating routine flaring by 2025. Such concrete goals are a good way to start in the right direction, he said. The commission has the authority to do a lot to address the issue, including under its mandate to end waste, Reed said. He charged that the Commission's failure to do so violates the Clean Air Act, because not just methane and carbon dioxide are emitted, but other substances such as hydrogen sulfide and sulfur dioxide. He offered several proposals on the march to zero routine flaring by 2025. End the practice of extending flaring permits beyond 6 months. Set a statewide goal of 2% for flaring volumes, and also set goals for individual operators. Require vapor recovery units on storage tanks, require additional inspections for companies getting exceptions to statewide Rule 32 to ensure flares are working properly. consider technology such as drones to monitor flaring and work with the industry to develop best practices and train on those practices. Commissioner Ryan Sitton asked that the commission should consider economics or molecules in taking action, citing as an example requiring companies to spend millions on vapor recovery units on storage tanks when the gas they'd recover was only worth thousands. Cyrus Reed said it's a balance and pointed out that other producing states such as Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico are also struggling to find that balance. Layden said there is opportunity to look at the economics, and in his discussion with industry operators, he has learned more about the economic concerns. He said regulators always make decisions that cost operators money, but he argued that technological advancements and innovation by the industry will render that argument moot. Christian asked about the group's opposition to pipelines and liquefied natural gas exporting facilities, and if they would be more supportive if the issues were addressed. Reed said if the problems of flaring and fugitive emissions were solved, that would lessen the impact of that pollution overall. If we could get to zero flaring, zero emissions, it would make those products that much cleaner than they are today in terms of environmental impact. This article is entitled "Audit Alleges Horseshoe Misused Public Funds" by Caitlin Randall. A report from the Midland County Auditor's Office alleges Horseshoe Hospitality, the management company behind the Horseshoe Complex, misused county funds by providing them as incentives to private promoters and donating them to a nonprofit entity. Public funds from a county government cannot be used to make gratuitous grants, except in cases with a legitimate public purpose under the Texas Constitution. Horseshoe Hospitality President Joe Kelly, however, disagreed with the audit's findings in a response provided to the report of Telegram. He stated the report misinterprets the contract between his company and Midland County and denies that providing incentives is an improper use of public funds. The auditor's office conducted a performance review of the Horseshoe Complex for the period between October 1, 2018 and September 30, 2019. While reviewing the Horseshoe's expenses, the auditor's office found $10,000 in public funds had been used inappropriately, according to the report. Midland County pays Horseshoe Hospitality a $140,000 flat fee annually, the report states. The county also provided $1.2 million in operational expenses for the 2019 fiscal year. According to the report, Horseshoe Hospitality used funds provided by the county to make donations totaling $5,500 and an incentive payment to a private company for $4,500. The report does not detail who the donations were made to. In his response, which will be presented along with the audit at Monday's Commissioner's Court meeting, Kelly said $5,000 of the $5,500 classified as donations in the audit was an incentive program given to Ultimate Calf Roping. Ultimate Calf Roping was promised a $20,000 grant from Visit Midland for its 2018 show at the Horseshoe, but was paid only $11,000 after the agency changed their grant criteria, according to Kelly. He said the UCR then informed the Horseshoe they would not be returning for another show in 2019. In exchange for UCR agreeing to stay at the Horseshoe, they were given $5,000 to be used toward marketing expenses, Kelly said. He said this is a legitimate expense and not a gratuitous grant, as stated in the auditor's report. The remaining $500 was a donation to Midland County Livestock Association Junior Livestock Show, Kelly said. He said he was not aware the donation would be an issue because his predecessor at Dooley Management Company made the same donation amount annually. Kelly purchased DMC and renamed it Horseshoe Hospitality. The $4,500 incentive payment was given to management for Cody Johnson, according to the auditor's report. Johnson held a concert at the Horseshoe Amphitheater on March 29, 2019, his website shows, and he has another concert scheduled there on October 31, 2020. His team was charged $4,500 to rent the facility in 2019, the report states, but he was given an incentive of lights and sound from Pantera Productions for an amount totaling $4,500. The audit found Horseshoe Hospitality paid Pantera Productions $4,500 for Johnson's lights and sound. Midland County also paid Horseshoe Hospitality $450 to cover their 10% portion of the rental fees, causing the county to be in the negative $450 in the rental of the facility for this event, according to the report. In his response, Kelly disagreed with the assertion that the county lost money from the deal, saying the county netted $18,000 in revenue from the concert. County Judge Terry Johnson said the county has found six occasions when the management company provided an incentive of $4,500 to a private entity. Kelly said in an interview, the payment for lights and sound wasn't a secret and was included in his budget request for that year. He said the payment should not be considered a grant. The lighting and sound equipment at the Horseshoe is substandard, Commissioner Scott Ramsey said in an interview. He said incentives are offered because it's less expensive to assist performers with renting the equipment than to purchase equipment for the Horseshoe. Ramsey serves as the commissioner's court liaison to the Horseshoe. The audit also states that Horseshoe Hospitality is not providing all revenue owed to Midland County, as outlined in the contract between the two entities. While the contract states Midland County should receive a certain percentage of all food and beverage sales, Horseshoe Hospitality has not been honoring that agreement on catering and bar setups, according to the report. Kelly said in his response that catering provided by Horseshoe Hospitality and bar setups do not fall under food and beverage sales, and the auditor's interpretation of the contract is incorrect. I have not shorted Midland County a dime, Kelly said in an interview. I pay on time every month. The report was scheduled to be presented by County Auditor Veronica Morales at the Commissioner's Court meeting on June 8th, but was tabled in a 3-2 vote, with Johnson and Commissioner Luis Sanchez casting the dissenting votes. Ramsey, who made the motion to table, said he wanted the report to be held until Kelly was able to respond to the audit's findings. He said Kelly was out of town on June 8th and could not read the report before it was scheduled to be presented. No auditor knows the inner workings of every business they audit, Ramsey said. Of the need for Kelly's response to be presented in conjunction with the report, they're going to interpret things they receive differently than what they are. County Attorney Russell Malm said he would be providing a written opinion on the legality of Horseshoe Hospitality providing incentives to private vendors. He declined to say what his opinion is before it's presented, along with the audit and Kelly's response at the upcoming Commissioner's Court meeting. The next Commissioner's Court meeting is scheduled for 9 a.m. June 22nd at the Midland County Courthouse. This article is entitled, Midland County District Clerk Arrested on DWI Charge, by Mercedes Cordero and Caitlin Randall. Midland County's district clerk was arrested June 10th after he was allegedly intoxicated while driving in downtown Midland, according to an arrest affidavit. Alex Archuleta, 60, was charged with driving while intoxicated, a Class B misdemeanor. His affidavit states a Midland police officer observed a car making a wide turn onto Big Spring Street and driving 10 miles per hour under the posted speed limit. The officer observed the driver, Archuleta, as he bounced between the white lines, according to the affidavit. When asked how intoxicated he was, Archuleta allegedly said, "Not that much." According to the affidavit, the officer could smell alcohol on his breath and observed that his eyes were bloodshot and glassy. The officer confirmed Archuleta was intoxicated after he consented to a field sobriety test. Archuleta was appointed district clerk by county commissioners in January 2018. He was elected in November of that year. He was appointed when Ross Bush resigned after pleading guilty to a felony charge of tampering with government records for changing his employees' time cards. Before he was district clerk, Archuleta worked in the county's purchasing department for several years and was recognized as the county's Employee of the Year in 2017, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. County Attorney Russell Malm said Archuleta would not automatically be removed from office if found guilty on the DWI charge because he is an elected official. This is the local page. This column is entitled, Lee Petitions Aren't Midland's First Encounter with Change.org, by Stuart Doreen. The recent news about the petitions having to do with the name of Robert E. Lee High School brought our attention to Change.org. Change.org is, quote, the world's platform for change, unquote, or a place for those wanting to create a petition, according to the website. Midlanders put Change.org to good use over the weekend. One petition was started on Saturday asking for Midland ISD leaders to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School. There were 2,855 signatures through 10 a.m. Tuesday. As many as three petitions were started on Sunday calling on leaders, even state and federal leaders, to keep the name of Robert E. Lee High School. The petition that has received the most attention had 2,044 signatures as of 10 a.m. Tuesday. Change.org, on its website, states it is a place where people everywhere are starting campaigns, mobilizing supporters, and working with decision makers to drive solutions. Midlanders have used it before. A search of Midland on the site shows petitions about plenty of Midland issues. Some have garnered a great deal of support, such as a petition started by an Austin woman earlier this month asking for justice for Ty Anders. As of Monday night, it had 25,788 signatures. Anders, who was arrested last month in Southeast Midland, received considerable attention in Midland and nationwide. That might be the reason for the three different petitions found under using just a Midland search involving Anders. All three were started by people living outside of Midland. There was one from a San Francisco woman who petitioned for charges to be dropped against Anders. It had 223 supporters as of Monday night. Another petition started by a Houston man appeared to have good intentions but missed on the execution, calling justice for Ty Anderson and grandmother. Still, his petition received 1,181 signatures as of Monday night. There have been other times that out-of-towners petitioned about things happening in our community. A petition to federal officials to stop Midland, Texas from coercing interstate drivers to violate hours of service regulations by a Small Business and Transportation Coalition official in 2018 received the support of 443. And in 2017, a South Carolina man called for the removal and replacement of the Midland Reporter-Telegram's Facebook manager. It didn't fare as well. It had six signatures. Midlanders have made their fair share of petitions. Last year, one was created targeting Union Pacific, calling for justice for all veterans killed by Union Pacific train. Sadly, the petition probably targeted the wrong group. Still, it received support from 1,163. Many of the petitions were directed at the Midland City Council. Over the past few years, petitions have included the need to preserve the Greenbelt as a single-family dwelling, 407 signatures, to protest mobile home park zoning near Hollandale Heights Park Palace, 91 signatures, to build a taco tote in Midland, 8 signatures, and to oppose the shipment of high-level nuclear waste through Midland, 1,815 signatures. Most recent petitions include a petition to stop Hillcrest Village, a housing development in West Midland. It had 267 supporters. There was a call to end corporate welfare in November, 172 supporters. The school district is another target of this type of community activism. In March, there were two different petitions calling for the cancellation of school because of COVID-19, 254 and 507 signatures respectively. There has been a call for metal detectors in all MISD schools, 487 signatures, and the elimination of Saturday football games for junior high students, 22 signatures. There was one petition that appeared to call for support for Goddard Junior High School leadership, 126 signatures. And more recently, there was a petition to have an open or outdoor graduation for the class of 2020, 411 signatures. Then there were a couple of petitions regarding Midland Christian School. It appears they were started by students and might not seek to change earth-shattering issues. The first calls for Midland Christian get school day off after Halloween. It received the support of 197. The other asked for the school to unblock Spotify on all MCS devices. That one received the support of 5. This article is entitled MISD to Engage Parents, Teachers About Reentry by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD is connecting with parents and teachers to talk more about reentry ahead of the 2020-21 school year. The district's chief of staff, Katie Atkins, told the Reporter Telegram this week that the district used the final three questions on the initial parent and teacher reentry surveys to help determine those who might be interested in being part of the discussions. She said invitations were sent via email to those who indicated an interest in participating. The meetings with teachers will take place this week. Elementary school teachers will meet 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. today, and secondary teachers will meet at the same time on Thursday. Meetings with elementary school parents are scheduled for 6:30 to 7:30 June 23rd, with secondary school parents on June 24th. All meetings will take place virtually in order for district officials to accommodate large groups. Those who wish to participate will receive an invitation via email to engage in those meetings, Atkins said. Parents and teachers are requested to RSVP via the form included in the email so we can gauge the number of participants. These meetings will allow the district to engage teachers and parents ahead of the August 19th start of the 2020-21 school year. The input during these meetings will help district officials with different scenarios based on recommendations from the Texas Education Agency. In the questionnaire survey sent out recently, the possible calendars received the most attention, but district officials also received information on virtual learning, medical concerns, and educational needs. Atkins said district officials have the bones and framework for reentry, and community members will help refine the test, including with the feedback provided during the meetings this week and next. This article is entitled, 20-year-olds make up majority of latest virus cases. Midland County count up to 238 from staff reports. Tuesday was another day of confirmed double-digit coronavirus cases, and the 20-somethings were a big reason for the continued spike. The Midland Health Department reported Tuesday another 16 confirmed cases. That increases the total to 37 this week, 109 this month, and 238 during the pandemic. In Ector County, there were 15 new cases reported Tuesday, bringing the overall total to 275. 9 of the 16 Midland County residents were men and women in their 20s. The next closest age group was residents in their 30s, 4. 20-somethings again took the overall lead when it comes to total COVID-19 cases inside Midland County, with 47 total. Residents in their 30s are second with 46. These two age ranges account for 39.07% of all coronavirus cases in Midland County. Young Midlanders are the reason for the June spike. This week alone, the health department reported that 33 of the 37 cases, or 89%, are those 49 or younger. As far as the cases on Tuesday, 11 of the 16 were female. The source of exposure for 8 was community acquired, and for 6 others, the source was travel. All confirmed cases are self-isolating at home, so hospitalizations remain low. The health department also reported Tuesday the confirmed cases were residents working at the following locations. The sales team, last worked June 9th. Little Woodrow's, last worked Saturday. Morrow Energy, last worked Monday. HEB on Loop 250, last worked June 5th. Region 18 ESC, last worked June 8th. Dillard's, last worked June 2nd. Rotenberry Wellen, last worked Friday. Morrow Energy, last worked Friday. Midland County, last worked at the courthouse on Friday. Reliant Energy, last worked June 9th. T-Claws, last worked Sunday. North American Tubular, last worked June 3rd. And Sundance Creek, last worked June 10th.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, June 17, 2020. Animal Magnetism. This is part of Animal Magnetism at the L. Noel Art Museum in Odessa. The exhibit by Kat Bunker, who uses the pseudonym Kat Truth, will be up through August. The San Angelo artist plans to be in attendance for the exhibit's closing reception on August 6. Animal Magnetism and the 62nd Annual Permian Basin Juried Art Exhibition may be viewed at noelartmuseum.org. Kits available to make Japanese-inspired cups. The L. Noel Art Museum has a limited number of kits for making Japanese-inspired tea or whiskey cups. Yunomi kits are used to make the cup at home. The cup can then be brought to the museum to be glazed and fired, according to a press release from ENAM. The kits are $19.99 and may be purchased at the museum gift shop through June 30. The kits contain wet clay, a wooden stick, and directions. The museum will post on its website an instructional video on how to create the cups. The last day to return the Yunomi kit will be July 2, and finished kits will be fired and ready for pickup on July 11. Art Talk. The museum has scheduled Art Talk for 6 p.m. Thursday. The discussion will be on a selected work from the permanent collection. The event is limited to 20 people, according to the release. City pools open on alternate days. Doug Russell Pool and Washington Family Aquatic Center are open, but because of staffing and coronavirus limitations, are operating on alternate days. Russell will be open Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Washington will be open Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. Both pools will be closed on Mondays for maintenance and training. Entry passes, which are $3, will be sold for three-hour sessions. They go on sale at the pool 30 minutes before the posted opening times and are good only for the day of purchase. Punch cards will not be sold this year. Because of staffing limitations and coronavirus precautions, there won't be private parties, lap swim times, swimming lessons, or family nights. Pool furniture will be removed from both pools, but swimmers will be allowed to bring chairs. The schedule is Washington, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday and Friday, 1 to 4 p.m. and 5 to 8 p.m. Sunday. Doug Russell, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Grocery store hours during coronavirus. United Supermarkets, formerly Albertsons Markets, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday. HEB, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Customer 60+. Orders can be called in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 833-397-0080. Groceries will be delivered by Favor Delivery. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com. Market Street, 6 a.m. to midnight. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. 7 to 8 a.m. curbside delivery pickup for first responders and customers 60+ with disabilities or at risk. Today in history. Today is Wednesday, June 17, the 169th day of 2020. There are 197 days left in the year. Today's highlight. On June 17, 1972, President Richard Nixon's eventual downfall began with the arrest of five burglars inside the Democratic headquarters in Washington, D.C.'s Watergate complex. On this date, in 1930, President Herbert Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which boosted U.S. tariffs to historically high levels, prompting foreign retaliation. In 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court in Abington, Pennsylvania, School District versus Shemp, struck down 8-1 rules requiring the recitation of the Lord's Prayer or reading of biblical verses in public schools. In 1994, after leading police on a slow-speed chase on Southern California freeways, O.J. Simpson was arrested and charged with murder in the slayings of his ex-wife, Nicole, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. Simpson was later acquitted in a criminal trial but held liable in a civil trial.
This is the opinion page. This column is called Guest View. It's entitled, Pandemic Has Offered a Chance to Make Memories with Family, from the Dallas Morning News. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, we've mourned deaths that have come too soon, had our hearts drop at the sound of wheezing or shaking breath from a loved one. We've had our workspaces move from offices to the confines of our homes. We've had our hours cut, our work put on hold, our jobs stripped from us. Our faces have twisted at the sight of yet another bill we can't afford. And yet, despite the confusion, pain, and fear we've endured these last few months, puzzles have gone flying off the shelves. Bicycles have become harder to find, and flour is low in stock because of high demand. That's a testament to a brighter side that's grown from the pandemic. People have had the opportunity to take more time for themselves and their families. Before the virus sent us home to self-isolate, it was typical for families to get lost in the flurry of work, school, household responsibilities, and extracurriculars that kept us always on the go. But it's this time away from some of those responsibilities, at least the need to drive to get to them, that has given us the ability to take time and to create memories by slowing down and appreciating the things we might not otherwise get to enjoy. College students and young adults have returned home to their parents for perhaps the longest period of time in years, something that some families didn't think would happen again. Kids aren't spending every free moment at after-school activities or with friends. For those for whom life has hit somewhat of a standstill, this has served as an unexpected chance to rekindle relationships. It's encouraging to see items such as puzzles and bicycles sell out because it indicates that people are taking the time to step away from their usual routines. This is a good reminder that there is more to life than work and responsibility, and we must remember that even as the line between work and home draws thin now that they both claim the same base, we must make time to take advantage of what's sitting right in front of us. When we look back on our lives, we won't remember the extra hours we spent at the office furiously typing the last few emails before heading home. We won't remember the busy schedules that kept us from sitting down to have a real meal with our households or from partaking in simple conversation. We'll remember the times we spent with loved ones and the quality of the relationship we've built. So take the time to complete a puzzle and go for a bike ride with a family member. Take time to break bread. Take the time to play a board game or play catch at the park. Have a conversation about aspirations or reflections. The memories are there for the making. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, June 17, 2020. Loretta Harrison. With profound sadness, we announce the passing of Loretta Harrison, our loving and devoted wife and mother and friend, to all whose lives she touched, on Saturday, June 13, 2020. She left us for her eternal home while at her residence in Midland, Texas. She was in her 84th year. Loretta was born and raised in northern Oklahoma, where she met the love of her life. She and Joe Harrison, along with their two best friends as witnesses, eloped to wed in Madison County, Arkansas on New Year's Day. Loretta and Joe were married 64 years. She is beloved mother of Marcella, Joe Jr., Tom, and Judy. She is grandma to several grandchildren and nana to seven great-grandchildren. Very few things in life brought her more joy than spoiling her grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her son, Joe Jr. Loretta was a kind and generous woman, always helping those in need. Everyone was welcome at her table. She continually served in some capacity at her church. Her charity knew no bounds. Most of all, she loved her family and instilled in her children strong values that have served them well. Loretta's family expresses their heartfelt thanks to the staff at Hospice of Midland, caregiver Nancy Perez, and Dr. Summer Merritt. Their professional and wonderful care will be treasured always. The family will receive friends from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, June 17th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A celebration of Loretta's life will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, June 18th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Brent Rushing. Brent Rushing, 34, of Lake Jackson, passed away June 12, 2020. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, June 18th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, June 19th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Margarita Villarreal de Jordan. Margarita Villarreal de Jordan, 85, of Midland, passed away Monday, June 15, 2020. Viewing will be Thursday, June 18th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service starting at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral services will be in Mexico. She is survived by two sons, Octavio Jordan, Miguel Jordan, eight daughters, Mara Ibeth Mendoza, Rose Magda Esparza, Maria Eusebi Villarreal, Consuelo Hernandez Villarreal, Nilda Hernandez Villarreal, Maribel Medrano Villarreal, Maria del Carmen Rubio, and Dina Oyoko Lares, two brothers and four sisters.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, June 17th. Police identified man fatally shot in central Odessa. Odessa Police Department spokesperson Corporal Steve LeSwear identified the 23-year-old man who was fatally shot in central Odessa during a phone call on Monday evening. The 23-year-old was identified as Midlander Kevin Portillo. The reported shooting happened at 3:38 a.m. Monday in the 1400 block of Wilshire Drive, an OPD press release stated. Officers reportedly found Portillo had been shot multiple times. Portillo was pronounced dead at the scene, and next of kin were notified. Investigations showed that after a disturbance, 29-year-old Jonathan Roy Dawkins shot Portillo multiple times before fleeing the scene on foot, the press release stated. The U.S. Marshals Lone Star Fugitive Task Force reportedly found Dawkins at 1 p.m. Monday in San Angelo. Dawkins was charged with capital murder, a capital felony. The 29-year-old was booked into the Tom Green County Jail at 1:53 p.m. Monday, jail records show. He was released at 12:28 p.m. Tuesday as he was extradited to Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He was booked into the Ector County Jail Tuesday afternoon, and bond has not been set. The investigation continues. COVID-19-related death at MCH. The story was written by Michael Merlo. Medical Center Hospital reported that a 72-year-old COVID-19 patient died at 2:21 a.m. Tuesday. The man was tested at a private facility on May 18th and was admitted to Medical Center Hospital on May 26th, where he had been on a ventilator. He was the seventh Ector County resident who died from COVID-19 complications. The Ector County Health Department detailed Tuesday that since Monday, there have been 15 more confirmed positive cases in the county, and 183 positive cases are active, while 275 cases have been confirmed, 83 cases are probable, and 168 COVID-19 patients have recovered from the virus. A health department press release detailed that 167 cases are pending. The release also detailed that 7 Focused Care at Odessa residents and 2 staff members have tested positive for the virus, 1 Deering's nursing home staff member has tested positive, and 1 Sienna nursing home staff member has tested positive. The health department detailed that a staff member from the Ector County Juvenile Probation Center has tested positive for COVID-19. The health department reported they will be hiring staff members to work COVID-19 and will post applications on the county page by the end of the week. Medical Center Hospital reported Tuesday that they have had 159 COVID-19 cases and 108 patients have pending test results. 14 COVID-19 patients are in the hospital and 2 were discharged in the last 24 hours. 1 new patient is from Alpine, and 5 are from Focused Care at Odessa. 2 are in the critical care unit, and neither are on ventilators, a press release detailed. Medical Center Hospital also detailed that 2 MCHS employees tested positive for COVID-19. The first is a receptionist at the Family Health Clinic on West University, who last worked on June 11th, which is when they started showing symptoms. The receptionist was behind a plexiglass shield and wearing a mask while at work. The second employee is a nurse who does not work on MCH's COVID-19 floors. Their last day at work was June 11th, which was 2 days before they started showing symptoms. The release detailed that the nurse was wearing a mask during the shift. Medical Center Hospital detailed that both cases are believed to be from community spread, and all patients and employees who were in contact with the employees during the days leading up to their positive results are being notified. After a Monday social media post went viral from a Twin Peaks Odessa employee, the Odessa restaurant reportedly temporarily closed for cleaning. The tweet detailed that the management of the restaurant failed to inform employees and the public that multiple employees had tested positive for the virus, quote, yet they refused to close to sanitize, end quote. Adriana Aranda, whose post went viral, said in a phone interview that one of her co-workers said they had tested positive for COVID-19 and suggested others should get tested in an employee group chat on Sunday. Quote, once she told us that, several others tested positive as well, she said. Aranda said she was on vacation when she received the message and said that, quote, not once did we hear from management. Not once did they text us all together to tell us that our employees have been testing positive, end quote. Aranda said she messaged her manager and asked what Twin Peaks Odessa would be doing, and she learned that they would not be closing down. Aranda said that she did not want to return to work until the restaurant would close to clean because of her 2 children, one who has a lung problem. After the conversation with her manager, she said her hours were changed on the online scheduling database. Aranda said that she thought she might be fired after her post went viral because of the changes to the scheduling app. Her post on Facebook has been shared more than 1,000 times as of Tuesday afternoon, while her initial tweet that turned into a thread of four was retweeted 188 times. Quote, "If they didn't fire me," she said, "I would have quit as well. If I were to go eat anywhere in Odessa or in Andrews and someone had tested positive and they didn't announce it to the community that their employees had it, I would be upset because I have kids, and yes, we all take a risk when going out, but you need to communicate with everyone and let them know someone has tested positive." End quote. Aranda said she believes some co-workers have reached out to the health department. CBS 7 reported that Twin Peaks Odessa temporarily closed on Tuesday for cleaning and sanitation. The sign detailed that the restaurant would be reopening at 5 p.m. Tuesday for dinner. Aranda said she didn't think the restaurant would have closed at all if her post didn't go viral. Quote, "I just wanted the public to be aware of it because there's much more people that are a higher risk than we could have been, and they deserve to know that they are possibly in more danger of catching it there," she said. She said she hoped that management would communicate more with employees after the post went viral. After multiple phone call attempts, Twin Peaks Odessa could not be reached for comment. An email from Brandy Garcia, director of the health department, detailed that Twin Peaks should have sent out their own press release when they found out they had positive staff members, because it can take time for the health department to gather information on where a positive patient works and has been. The health department needs to get reports that a person is confirmed before the investigation begins, she detailed. Quote, "I will get with the investigators and determine how many positives we have from Twin Peaks," she wrote. Hector County ISD officials learned Monday night that one of the Odessa High School athletes taking part in the school's UIL strength and conditioning program tested positive for COVID-19. That athlete is in quarantine and will need a written release from a medical doctor when it is okay to return. The remaining players and coaches have been notified and are also taking all recommended precautions, a news release said. For the safety of everyone involved in the program, all summer strength and conditioning work on the OHS campus is suspended for at least the next 14 days. Athletic department officials are reviewing the existing systems to ensure guidelines are effective and will make adjustments if necessary. Per University Interscholastic League allowance, OHS and Permian High School began summer strength and conditioning on June 8th. The schools are using the health and safety guidelines established by the UIL and the Texas Education Agency. Those can be found on our ECISD Athletics Department webpage, tinyurl.com/Y2JFM65X. COVID-19 News by the Numbers. Hector County confirmed cases, 275. Hector County negative, 3,652 out of 4,094 tested, with 167 pending. 7 deaths. Midland County, 225 confirmed cases with 13 deaths. Texas, 93,206 confirmed cases with 1,522,434 tested. Total Texas deaths, 2,029. U.S. cases, 2,104,346 total confirmed cases and 116,140 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Annual Street Seal Coat Project. The City of Odessa Annual Street Seal Coat Project is set to start today. Wagner and Company, out of Kendalia, is contracted to seal coat approximately 29 linear miles of streets. The project will begin with major streets and will finish up with residential streets. The project is expected to last 5 to 7 days. Streets to be seal coated this year include 8th Street from Grant to County Road West, 52nd Street from Dixie Boulevard to Andrews Highway, 87th Street from Andrews Highway to Hunter Miller Way, Grandview Avenue from Loop 338 to Yukon Road, Stony Ridge Road from Eastridge Road to Newell Road, Newell Road to Business 20, Golder Avenue from Kermit Highway to 46th Street, 7th Street from Royalty Avenue to Dixie Boulevard, Clement Street from Grant Avenue to South Crane Avenue, residential streets east of Grandview Avenue, south of University Boulevard, north of Oakwood Drive, and west of JBS Parkway, and residential streets east of Grandview Avenue, south of 42nd Street, north of University, and west of JBS Parkway. Overeaters Anonymous, a 12-step support group, has scheduled meetings from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Mondays and 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursdays at Christ Church Anglican, 5501 North Midkiff Road in Midland. The meetings are free and open to the public. For more information, call 553-1031 or visit oa.org.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.